Welcome to Studio Tulsa. I'm Scott Gregory, sitting in today for Rich Fisher. We offer on our program another installment in our ongoing series of Museum Confidential podcasts. Museum Confidential, now in its sixth season, is a co-production of Public Radio Tulsa and Philbrook Museum of Art. And this particular show offers an interesting interview with John Lurie, the musician, painter, actor, director, and producer. A quite versatile creative type who's also quite accomplished. He's best known probably for his work with the Lounge Lizards, a jazz band and experimental music outfit that developed quite a cult following in New York in the 1980s. He's also been in several films. He's written the music for several films. And he appeared in and wrote, directed, and produced the Fishing with John program, which was sort of like a reality TV show before we had reality TV. A reliably off-the-wall or avant-garde artist who always brings a lot of humor and whimsy to his work, Lurie has more recently been working on Painting with John, which is now, I suppose the second season is now in production. The first season aired on HBO to much acclaim, the New York Times calling it a meditative and often joyful blend of painting and personal storytelling, but Bob Ross, it isn't. John Lurie's also the author of a newly published memoir, The History of Bones. And we'll hear about all of the above in this installment of Museum Confidential. Thanks for tuning in.
Life is so beautiful. For some, more than others. Every breath. Every day of our lives. Ah, fishing.
According to the Encyclopedia Britannica, the concept of the Renaissance man is one that developed during the Italian Renaissance from the notion expressed by one of its most accomplished representatives, Leon Battista Alberti, who said, "A man can do all things, if he will." Imagine, if you will, a man who finds success in the worlds of music, acting, painting, and writing. Is this what we might call a Renaissance man? I'm not sure, but it certainly describes one John Lurie. For more than 40 years, John Lurie has been exploring his creative interests. Let's list it off. He co-founded the influential jazz group The Lounge Lizards. He acted in and composed the scores for several early Jim Jarmusch films. He explored the boundaries of reality TV years before anyone else with his short-lived but beloved show, Fishing with John. He even played one of the apostles in Martin Scorsese's The Last Temptation of Christ. For the past 20 years or so, John has turned most of his attention to painting, a pursuit chronicled in the recent HBO show, Painting with John. This big, wild life, at least the first several decades of it, are the subject of John's memoir, The History of Bones. I'm your host, Jeff Martin, and this is Museum Confidential.
I really enjoyed the book. It was a much faster read than I was anticipating. I kind of sat down with it, ended up just plowing through it in a couple of days, and really, you know, I thought I kind of knew your work and you a little bit. Yeah, I've been following you for a long time, but it was pretty revelatory in the sense of where all the creative impulses come from. And the book, to me, kind of seemed to come out of nowhere. I was kind of like not expecting the book, and then all of a sudden I see this big memoir coming. Is that something you've been thinking about for a long time? Has it been in progress for many years? Where did that project come from?
I started writing it in 2001. I got really sick and was writing it quickly because I didn't think I was going to be here much longer. So I was writing it really fast, and then I put it aside because I got too sick to even continue. And then out of the blue, Ben Greenberg from Random House said, you know, would you like to write a book? And I've already written one, but what I really want to do is write about the last 20 years. He said, well, no, what I think would be best would be a memoir of New York, downtown New York in the 1980s. And I said, well, that I have that. But so I kind of wrote this one to sort of write the next one. So this was my audition. And I actually had it in the book, but Ben asked me to take it out, which was while we were doing the movie Last Temptation of Christ, and all the people, they were mostly non-actors and they wanted to do a good job. And at lunch, they asked, Michael Biehn was asking Harry Dean Stanton, how do you prepare to play a saint in a movie? And Harry just said, every movie I do, I'm just auditioning for the next one, which was kind of what I was doing with this book. So I could write, it has to be a God or it couldn't get this weird, which was what I really wanted to write. So I wrote this one. I got into writing this one.
So this is kind of a part one in a way. That's how you see it?
In a way, but at the moment.
It contains a lot. This book contains multitudes. It's more than just New York in the 1980s, of course. It's much more than that.
You know, it's like with anything, it's like with painting, with music, with writing, it's your chops go away. Or I didn't have any chops, and then I developed them as I went. And then I stopped writing, and then it took a minute for them to come back. So I would like to write a second book, yeah. But I'm not really answering your very first question. But I wrote it a lot of it a long time ago. I wrote the meat of it a long time ago, and then went back and did three passes on it in the last couple of years to make it more what they were asking me to write.
Do you think that if you hadn't started writing it 20-odd years ago now, that your memory would still be as good?
Yeah, no. And there were stories in there. It was like, really? That happened? There were some stories. So it kind of was cool because it gave me some distance from it. It's like, oh, that doesn't, it was like reading. It was like reading about somebody else, some of it, because it was so far removed. And some things, thank God I wrote that stuff 20 years ago, because I wouldn't have remembered.
Some people say, they'll put the first draft away for a month and look at it. You gave yourself, many years to do that. And it probably helped in the long run, having that editorial eye on the work that you'd already done. This is the 30th anniversary, I believe, of when Fishing with John came out. 1991, I think, is when it first came out. And I came to your work then. That was the first thing I had ever seen of you. I think I was 11 when that came out. And it was...
You were 11.
And I think what was cool about it, in some ways, I look back on it and it was so different. In some ways, it was kind of my introduction to the avant-garde in a way, because I didn't know how to define it or understand what it was. Because when you look at it now, you look at it and there's almost all these contemporary comps, like, a travel show, like a Anthony Bourdain show or any of these kind of things that seem like you can relate to it now. But back then, it just wasn't definable to me, and I couldn't tell kind of what was scripted, what was real, what was meant to be tongue-in-cheek, what wasn't. And it became more so, as I got older and understood irony and humor and all those things more and more. But as an 11-year-old kid watching it, it was a kind of a wonder to me. My long question here leads to this. It's 30-odd years later. That show still has it has a long tail. People still watch it. They talk about it, hear it referenced. There's only 6 episodes, right? Why do you think it endures?
And now you're going to put me in a position where I have to compliment myself. It's kind of like asking a quarterback if he thinks he should be in the Hall of Fame when he retires. You know?
You can do it 30 years later. If it's 30 years later, you can do it.
But Anthony was really upfront about what an influence Fishing with John was. I wish Jerry Seinfeld would stand up and admit that what he's doing had something,
Show about nothing, yeah.
Well, no, but the, Comedians in Cars, I must have been told 4,000 times, hey, Jerry Seinfeld stole your idea. I must have heard this 4,000 times.
Actors in Boats Catching Fish.
Yeah, but where do you see a season 2 of Painting with John? It's going to be the weirdest thing ever on television. I'm really excited about it. We're editing it now. And there's these sections called Cowboy Beckett, where... we put a green screen in the living room and we sat on stools and we bounced up and down. And I wrote this kind of Morricone-esque music. And then we arrive and then Anne-Marie says, I'm the law in these here parts. And then it cuts into Nezrin, who really kind of looks like Charles Bronson, like those close-ups at the beginning of Not the Good, the Bad, and the Ugly, Once Upon a Time in the Way. Yeah. And Nezrin says, some dollars are more dangerous than others. And it doesn't make any sense. And it's like, we do like 5 lines and then we'll ride out, right? But I think it's going to be just great. I'm so excited about this. But I hope it's not better in my mind than when it actually is when we finally edit it. But I think it's going to be really good.
So you say Cowboy Beckett. Of course, we're talking Samuel Beckett and the kind of the theater of the absurd and some of those things.
It's really more Ionesco than Beckett, but just Cowboy Ionesco just didn't have the right ring to it. So
that makes sense.
Yeah.
Are those guys important to you? I mean, looking back on that, I mean, it seems like you've always had an affinity for, you know, the non sequitur or the kind of, I don't know, how do you kind of describe that? Because I've been trying to think about your work in the sense of like, what's the common thread through the paintings and the book and the acting choices and the music, of course. It's too easy to say it's just like, well, that's just you, you know, like your personality. There has to be something that connects them all. I don't know. Is it an ideology? Is it an idea? You know,
I don't know how to define it so much, but there is an app between the music and the painting for sure. And fishing with John and painting with John. And the book, I don't know, because I never wrote a book before. And that was different. Like with the music and with the painting, I'm just doing them. I'm not doing them thinking about that they're going to be heard or seen. You know what I mean? But with a book, you're only writing a book so people can read it. You're not writing it so it can, do you know what I mean? So that's what puts you in a whole different mindset somehow. It's like, I'm writing this to be read. But I don't know what the connecting thing is. I mean, the connecting thing is me. And there is, I mean, I don't know if you saw one of my paintings and then heard my music and didn't know anything about me, would you say, I wonder if that's the same guy? I don't know if that would happen, you know?
That's a good point, actually, because, you know, shifting over to Painting with John, which was such an enjoyable first season and kind of a perfect, I don't know, it was kind of like the perfect thing for a year of quarantine and,
you know, I got lucky with the timing. Well, I made it to cheer people up, but it was before I sort of saw the quarantine coming before most people did. But I really was making it to cheer people up. But I kind of knew. I was reading about the coronavirus in China. It's like, well, this is going to go. I just knew it was going to go. I didn't know how badly, you know, the U.S. was going to handle it and stuff. But I knew it was going to really... what we feared of Ebola, I thought was going to actually really, you know, like those,
yeah,
that movie with where Dustin Hoffman saves the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. It's a kind of a good movie, right?
Hey, it's a, you know, as far as pandemic movies go, it's top five for sure. I think, you know,
was that the way, is Matt Damon in that one or he's in another one?
He's in Contagion. You know,
it's a different one.
Yeah. And then you got like Andromeda Strain. You got lots of those, you know, those movies. I'm curious to know when you did Fishing with John, and it kind of became this cult object fairly quickly, but certainly by like mid to late 90s, and it was like on the Criterion Collection and it had been picked up and people talked about it. It was almost like this, like, you know, there's that famous quote, right? Like that no one listened to the Velvet Underground, but every band that came, you know, after them was influenced by them, that kind of thing. And you can see that influence, but I'm just curious, were you ever offered, so there's, you know, 30 years between basically Fishing with John and Painting with John, was there ever this idea that there'd be blank with John, another season blank with John, like you'd be tackling different things all the time because you do have such varied interests? Is there a music with John or jazz with John? Were you offered things like that?
Well, no, not really. And this wasn't, I was offered. We just made Painting with John to make it. We didn't. And that it ended up on HBO was just kind of by a nice accident.
So this was like on spec almost, basically.
And it wasn't even that. It was just to me and Eric Marcus, we were just going to make these little 2-minute things to put on Instagram to cheer people up. And then he turned out to be really good at everything. And so it just grew. It just grew and grew. And then it was like, well, we have 3 hours of footage here, maybe. But no, I wasn't getting offered stuff. I'm getting a lot of offers to act in movies all of a sudden, which is strange, but
right now.
Yeah, but they still try to make you jump through all the hoops. And I just said, no, I'm sorry. You know what I mean? It's like, they don't just say, okay, you can have the part, you know, are you available these dates? You still have to stand on your head and wear purple pants. And yeah.
Well, it does feel like a comeback of sorts. I mean, I think I don't want to spend too much time on this, but, you know, so much of this 21st century for you has been really tied up in some serious medical problems, and you had to kind of put some things on hold for various reasons. And
yeah, and there was the stalker thing, and I was really sick. And then what the New Yorker did, the New Yorker just was a devastation to my life, what they did. The impact of what that article did was, and I just disappeared. I was going to just disappear. I was done after that. And
and that was, you know, what, 2013, 2014. And so it's been, you know, almost a decade. And then all this, all of a sudden this show comes on, which kind of, like I said, to me was a surprise. Then this book drops and it kind of feels like, hey, there's a lot of content all of a sudden coming from John Lurie. And also the music that you do for the show and all that. So there's a lot of different creative outlets kind of all happening at once. What's it feel like to kind of burst all of that out into the world, you know, all, in basically a calendar year?
My mind is bouncing from things are a little bit mayhem around here at the moment. So
I mean, because of deadlines and all the different projects you have going?
Yeah, and because of all things overlapping, like the book with the editing and the audio book with like, doing the music, I did new music for the second season of Painting with John, and the audiobook ended up overlapping that. So I was sleeping like 3 hours a night to get everything done. And then I went straight from that down to the island to shoot the show. And I was burnt out, you know. So, but the opportunity is so golden, I kind of got to rise up to do it, you know. You didn't hear from me, but I was painting 12 hours a day. But you just weren't hearing from me, you know?
And you do have a social media presence. That's where I would follow you. I would see your work there. And that's a good point. It wasn't as if you were completely absent. You had taken on painting and we would see that. But I guess we weren't necessarily hearing your voice or seeing your face or kind of getting to see that. You were kind of using that painting and through your website and Twitter and different places to kind of express what you were doing. And your first kind of gallery show really started, what, 2003, 2004, around there, you started showing work more regularly?
2004, Anton Kern was the first real show.
And since then, you've kind of shown all over the world, and painting has become this center thing. When people read the book, they'll know that painting has been part of your life for a long time. It's not as if you just started painting for the first time ever in 2004. But
around 2002, it became my primary thing. It was something I dabbled in before that, you know.
One of my favorite things about your work generally is just that wit behind it, which I think is always there. And I think the titles of your paintings, in some way, I'm kind of answering my own question. I was asking kind of what connects all of them. When I look at the titles of your pieces, in some ways, those things really reflect the general idea there. I'm thinking of like, I Love a Man in a Unicorn, which I thought was one of my favorite titles of a piece. Or there's one called I Have Moved to a Bucket Inside a Cave. Please Do Not Visit. Thanks. That's the title of the piece. Do these things just pop in your head? Do the titles come first and then you paint from that? Or do you?
When the title comes first, the painting always ends up contrived. The title should come about 2/3 of the way through. That seems to be the best thing. You know, we had a terrible time with the title of the book.
Which is called The History of Bones, we should say.
Yeah, but for a long time, when I started writing it back in 2001, it was called What Do You Know About Music? You're Not a Lawyer. And then on our second pass through with Ben Greenberg, we both got tired of the title at the same time. What Do You Know About Music? You're not a Lawyer. Which I like, but we just got tired of it. So then what came to me, and I couldn't defend it, but the title Fark Fark Indubitably, I really wanted to, that came to me like strong, like that was the title. But and Ben was like, and he went to his bosses and then, well, you know, they don't like it. And it was like one of those, I couldn't defend it. There was no defending it. I just liked it. And it didn't mean anything. It was just a sound. But Fark Fark Indubitably, that. But and then it was like it was going to be maybe Mutiny on the Bowery. And then
that's a good one, a little punny, but good.
Yeah, but that's too cute. And then the Book of John was already taken, so I couldn't call it that. No. But that was my sister's favorite. She was like, Book of John, you have to call it the Book of John. And then Nezra said, well, why don't you go and look at your paintings and pick one from that? And so we were going to, there's a painting called Bones Are on the Outside, and we were going to call it that. And then I wanted to use the word squalor in there, but I was really, you know, that the History of Bones is actually from a Jean-Michel Basquiat painting where he had written that in the corner of one of his paintings and then crossed it out. So it was sort of a little nod to him, but nobody realizes that it is. But yeah.
You know, speaking of that, we just did a show with a graphic artist and former graffiti artist, Say Adams, who was the first creative director for Def Jam and was, you know, kind of there as a graffiti artist alongside Basquiat and Keith Haring and all those people. And you were around that whole world too. when you know you were kind of in that space and you were thinking of yourself as a visual artist when you were thinking about painting or doing other things like that, would you have been more nervous to show work around that time, kind of being around that world? You know, do you ever have, you know, imposter syndrome or any of those things when you're saying, hey, I do painting as well, but you're, you know.
No, I kind of watched this happen and I knew all those guys. I mean, but also like, you know, Francesco Clementi and Julian and Jean-Michel and I had paintings then, and I just, in the movies, you know, Stranger, and I was like, I could have had shows of the paintings then, but I just thought, that's kind of garish. Or so I just held it back. I just didn't, you know what I mean? I waited. But then so a lot of the people who I thought should have been a big deal, like Richard Morrison, Steve Kramer, Ramel Z, A1, I thought that they were going to become big deals too, and they didn't. But I can tell you one thing. I was in Montreal. I had a museum show in Montreal, and this is a while ago when I was just 2008. They weren't. I feel confident about the paintings now, but at the time I was like, kind of like, am I an imposter? And they brought me into this room, and it was mostly all guys I knew. It was like George Kondo and Clemente and David Bowes and Chris Wool. And I looked around at the paintings, like, no, I'm fine. My stuff is good. I think, you know, I'm okay. And then they brought me through the rest of the museum. And the rest of the museum, they were doing this, you know, museums are so desperate trying to get people in there. They were doing this thing of Disney. And it was all Disney art and da-da-da. But then they would have this Disney painting next to like a Bruegel or a Degas to show what it was coming from. And you could just, I mean, from 50 yards away, you'd see the Bruegel on the wall and you would just like go like, oh, that has a weight to it. That has an aura and a weight to it. And then I went back to my room and it was just like, oh, I am an imposter. I got no business. Just because my friends are pulling it off to be on the walls here. When I look at like the real stuff that's supposed to be in a museum, it's like, oh. But now I think I might do okay. But 2008, it was like, oh, yo, I got some work to do, you know?
This episode of Museum Confidential is brought to you by doodling. Though not nearly as respected or socially acceptable as drawing, doodling is a beloved pastime for millions. Before the advent of smartphones, there was really no better way to get through a boring meeting than doodling on a yellow legal pad, and with enough distance and a serious furrowed brow, you could even pass off your doodling as real work.
I'm just jotting down some notes here, Bob. Carry on.
Need to pass the time on a never-ending call with your bank or your insurance company? Doodling is here for you. For more on doodling and how to get started, visit DIYdoodles.org. That's DIYdoodles.org.
I was watching a documentary that was made on you like in 1990, 91. It kind of follows you on a European tour where you're doing music and different things like that. And you're talking about having just filmed Fishing with John. It had not come out yet. And you were talking about how weird this thing was you just made. You didn't think anybody was going to know what to make of it. And of course, you're playing music and you were playing with a young man who was playing bucket drums. This kind of young guy who's probably like
Larry Wright. Yeah.
And so I was watching that and, you know, you have these amazing kind of moments with him and you can kind of see you looking at him and see the crowd. You had kind of brought this kid along and there's this kind of pride and you feel like you're kind of exposing him and all these things. And the moments in where the music is really taking off, you can kind of see yourself disappearing into it. Do you miss live performance? When's the last time you played music?
I don't know. You know, I don't even want to talk about that because the loss of that is like... No. I don't know how to talk about it, and I don't even look at it. It's pain. You know what? I don't know how to talk about it. Because we did music for season two, and I was over ambitious because it was the first music I'd done for other people. I did the Marvin Pontiac Asylum like 3 years ago, but that was all me playing everything. But now I had musicians come in, and it was the first time in 25 years I'd done that. And then I just was reminded of all the reasons that I hated it, you know, like just trying to arrange it. And like, you know, I don't want to hear about, you know, that your babysitter is not there. You know what I mean? It's like, because I can't do it anymore, I was reminding myself of the bad part of it.
Right.
But it's about as high as you can go in this life. You know, that thing where it's when it's good and you've been playing a bunch of nights and you all know the material and you also know where it went on Tuesday, where it went on Sunday and where it could go now. And it's sort of hovering off the ground and you're loving the people you're playing with. There's nothing that comes close to that. I mean, I imagine winning an NBA championship maybe comes close to that, but I don't think it really does. I think it's about as high as you can go. So, yeah, sort of block that out of my mind, you know?
So as we kind of wrap up here, I'm curious to know, one of the things that comes through in Painting with John is this sense that you're talking to us, the audience, and you're kind of letting us in this world. But it feels very much like you've kind of created this space for reasons you've talked about. We don't need to get into that. You know, you mentioned what happened with like the New Yorker and other things, but you know, there were reasons why you kind of had to isolate. Has that isolation been both good and bad? You know,
it was 90% good. It was the best thing that could have happened to me. I mean, I just sort of gave up. I just said, okay, I'm going to just live on this island and I'm not going to be in public life anymore. And I'll just make these paintings. And my health started to slow. You know, I got in the water every day, which was huge. And then I just started over a different kind of life. It was almost all good. There was almost no bad to it. You know, once I made the adjustment, it was incredibly lonely at first. But then after a while, it was like, no, you know, and Nezrin helped me get through all that too. And then she moved down there eventually, which also made it better. But, and Anne-Marie is great. So I like my life. I mean, I'm not there right at the moment, but I'm mostly there.
For more than three decades, Tony Shafrazi was one of New York's leading art dealers, representing the estates of Francis Bacon, Keith Haring, as well as countless notable contemporary artists. But on February 28, 1974, Shafrazi was arrested for spray painting Picasso's 1937 anti-war painting, Guernica, in a gallery at the Museum of Modern Art. He spray painted the words, "Kill lies all." He intended to write the words, "All lies kill," in some strange connection to James Joyce's novel Finnegan's Wake. When caught by security, Shafrazi shouted, "Call the curator, I am an artist." The act was supposedly an act of protest in response to the Vietnam War, specifically the perceived lack of accountability for the perpetrators of the infamous My Lai massacre. The spray paint was removed fairly easily since the painting was heavily varnished. Shafrazi was later given 5 years probation without a trial. Well, that's our show for this week. Museum Confidential is produced and edited by Scott Gregory in the studios of Public Radio Tulsa. Additional production assistance from Jack Dean. Theme music by Broncho. For more on the museum and the station, visit philbrook.org or publicradiotulsa.org or both. As always, we suggest both. Until next time, look closer.